Hi, everyone, and hi, everyone streaming at home. Thank you to Matt Ruby. Round of applause. Woo! Again. Catherine, did you bring your stickers? You didn't bring your stickers, did you?
Oh, no. Was I supposed to bring my own? I have a I didn't vote sticker, which has healed something in my heart. So
she's got a whole roll of them. I got
I'll share mine later with anybody who can prove to me they didn't vote.
Stickers. I've got a couple of things, items of house cleaning. First, before we start, this is all rapid fire. The whole thing is a lightning round. But first, this is all being live streamed right now. Hello, live stream people at home, including hopefully my daughter, Coco. Hi, Coco. I'll try to keep it PG-13. So that means if any of you are going to do a live striptease or have a Q&A, whatever libertarians people do, you're going to be broadcasting to a lot of homes, so keep that in mind.
Wow, I didn't know.
See, exactly, Pete Suderman. Also, there is going to be, so time is of the essence, at around 7:25-ish, we're going to have some Q&A that's going to be over here, and if you have more of a comment than a question, we're going to send animal control into your house. And then at 7:40, you're going to be Bull Connor hosed out of here as soon as possible.
Too
so get
soon.
All your stuff, too soon. Get all your bills settled, and then we're going to go up to the three sheets. So, drink, and Catherine's going to pass out her I didn't vote stickers, and I'll pass out these things. And I think we have recent socks, so that's exciting for everybody. Just to release the tension here, how many people have voted? Can you make some noise already?
Wow.
Boo. Holy cow. Okay. How many people are going to vote tomorrow? Okay. Right. How many people are on team I didn't vote or I'm never going to vote?
Okay. There it is. Bad. The few and the proud.
And just to get a sense of those who are not going to not vote, Trump? Wow. Really? Seriously? Not a single person here voted for Trump? Oh, okay. All right. There we go. Kamala Harris? Bunch of communists in this room. That's great. Chase Oliver?
Woo! There it is. Man.
This is a totally representative sample of the American population.
We're basically Nate Silver here.
Yeah. Catherine, before we actually get started, do you want to give some kind of atheist robot election eve prayer or benediction?
No, because I do not recognize this as a spiritually significant day.
Nick, you're either microdosing now or microdosing tomorrow. What are you microdosing?
It's all good, man.
Okay. I would ask Peter, but we have a time limit here. So,
whatever you order from the bar, just make sure it has as much fluoride as possible, because this might be your last night.
This is
that
it.
That is true. That is true. We're going to talk mostly tonight in terms of hopes and fears, and let's be honest, there's not really a lot of hopes. So we're going to talk a lot about fears about the election, and the first round is going to be mostly, not necessarily the fear of what if this guy wins, what if this not guy wins, or whatever. It's going to be like, what is a plausible bad outcome that could happen, or a combination of things that could happen yesterday. If we talk about it, maybe it won't happen, but something that you think is within the realm of possibility, because we've had some kind of bad things happen in recent years. Catherine, why don't you lead us off?
Sure. So my first and greatest fear is that one of them will win. And it seems really likely to occur. But more realistically, what I am worried about actually is that we're going to have like a Schrodinger's cat election result in which both of them have won and both of them have lost. And people are mad about all four of those things at once. And I legitimately think we could have kind of violence in various parts of the country premised on any combination of that of those outcomes in a way that will be very hard to quash, because you can't say, oh, people who are rioting because Donald Trump won and they think that Harris should have won, calm down, Donald Trump won, if there are people on the other side of the country rioting in the opposite scenario. That's my like kind of long tail fear. I don't think that's super likely, but it's not 0% likely.
Nick, what are your fears beyond having to share a stage with me for the next hour?
That Chase wins, but then it turns out the birth certificate was fake. Yes. But I've never seen his birth certificate. So I'm worried.
Peter?
I mean, you're asking a libertarian like what he's worried about in a race between a cringy statist and a big government authoritarian. It's as with Catherine, the fear is that one of them will win. But the second fear is that maybe neither of them will. Nate Silver currently has the possibility of an electoral college tie at 0.4%. That is not a very high percentage. On the other hand, look at what has happened for the last 4 years. All of the crazy things that were never supposed to happen have happened, and so that is what I worry about.
So I had a chaotic thought 2 or 3 days ago, so this is my current...
Is just it worry? One.
Worry, or is it like kind of rooting for it? I'm not sure yet. So it's some scenario that Catherine Peter, it's super close, no one really knows, it's heavily contested, and then suddenly, Joe Biden resigns. Right? Like, I haven't like actually completed the thought, but like if it's resigned and then Kamala Harris is now the president and she has to decide things. Maybe there's rioting and there's National Guard. Who calls it in? Just like there's some chaos there that I feel like it's possible to happen. I'm rooting for it. Let's be honest.
I definitely think chaos is possible.
So let's talk about fears of the individual candidates winning. What is the worst plausible thing that we think could happen under a Kamala Harris presidency? Nick Gillespie.
I think that there is an outbreak of foreign policy problems all over the world because she's perceived as weak and stupid and out of it. And that's now. So, yeah, that's the biggest worry about me under Kamala. If Kamala wins, suddenly it makes a lot of sense to start invading everywhere.
Peter.
I think the worst thing that might happen if Kamala Harris wins is that something might happen. Like anything that's big and important, something terrifying and terrible, whether it's foreign policy or domestic, because has anybody, like, something's going to happen and she'll be in charge. Has anybody here like actually watched a full interview with Kamala Harris? I mean, they're short because she hasn't given many of them. Have you come away with the impression that she's like quite sharp, that she processes new information quickly and in a way that is going to help us when there's a crisis, when something is happening that she wasn't, you know, scripted for in advance? That is my fear, is that she is somebody who has risen up through the ranks of politics, not by making good decisions, not by being good at governance, but instead by playing an inside game with the party. And that's the thing that she's good at. But what she's not demonstrated any ability at doing is, hey, here is something new that needs to be dealt with right now. You've got to think about this and you've got to run this through either an ideology or just make a decision based on the facts on the ground. Learn what's happening. She's not shown that she can do that at all.
Catherine, I remember when we were doing, I think, a live show in D.C. and we were talking about what we'd like for different types of entertainments that have something to do with D.C. And you and Nick both really liked the Veep as a concept of that. I'd never watched Veep, but how are we on the Veep progression of Kamala Harris? Is she like sticking to the script every single part of the way?
Very much so. Extremely, very much so.
Can you explain for the normies?
It's just every single step of the way, it's like, surely the country will notice that this person is a joke and a fraud. And then the country's like, nope, looks fine. And they just proceed along. And again, you know, the country has not noticed that many, many, many of the politicians put forth to them for the presidency are a joke and a fraud. But there's something in the Kamala Harris energy, the coconut tree of it all, that just really brings the Veep.
So what is your nominee for the worst plausible thing that can happen under a Harris presidency?
This is like a little bit smaller ball, but I do think just housing policy is going to be real, real messy under Harris.
But she proposed rent control.
Yeah, great. Right. So we've got your price controls. You've got your like kind of confusing subsidy, maybe for first-time home buyers. You've got subsidies for construction companies, maybe if they build stuff in cities, maybe question mark. All the details are very unclear. But one thing I think that's emerges over and over is that like people feel very strongly about wanting to buy a house. I think you should never buy a house, and we can talk about that later. But
sold.
I know my room, but that is the kind of thing that people will dump infinite money to and get negative results. And Harris seems super willing to do that. So,
Nick, do you, you're a connoisseur of really bad 1970s after school cinema. Do you remember seeing a thing called Cypher in the Snow ever? It was shown this in 10th grade health class, I think.
Really?
Yeah.
Sounds about, fascinating.
Yeah, it was really, I think we should talk about it.
Is this, like, is this your Degrassi Junior High?
I thought this was supposed to be a lightning round. But,
Yes, it's the round where we all hope to get struck by lightning.
Does it have a relevance here?
I'm just kind of, so like Joe Biden's the president right
in
now?
In theory.
Sure.
In theory.
Sure.
So we have an in theory president, and like all kinds of stuff's happening. He's like wandering on tarmacs now.
But he's jogging now. He's, you know, he's jogged out west. I don't know if he came back from that trip.
Got a little bit of a trot. Yeah. Like, what if like we go from Joe Biden, who's not really the kind of the president, to someone who's just a cipher in the snow? Like, who the fuck does? Sorry, Coco. Who's running the country?
It's well, and then we also do. It could stop at the guy who performed fellatio on a microphone. I mean, who was doing like the Madonna tour from the late '80s? So we got nothing but blue skies ahead of
us. It is kind of, you know, there was this thing that was going around where people were like, libertarians have been in charge for too long. Like the neoliberal consensus has been for too long. First of all, now and always, I'm sorry that I missed that moment. But I do think this is also a little bit of like the, you know, be careful what you wish for. Like, we were like, what if there was no president? What if no one was in charge? This isn't what we meant. This isn't what we meant.
No, but, you know, I don't worry about stuff going wrong in America, because even something like housing policy, that's going to unfold over months, if not years, the pace that the government moves at. It really is, if people outside of the country are like, oh, this is a good time to start doing a lot of weird shit. To me, that's because that'll be instantaneous and immediate. And, you know, we won't have the wherewithal to leave it alone.
Nick, I was told your whole life philosophy was maybe it's time to start doing some weird shit.
Yeah. All right. So then that means, depending on who wins tomorrow night, I'm invading Taiwan.
Speaking of accelerationism, so let's shift to the worst plausible thing that will happen if the Republican nominee, Donald Trump, becomes president. Catherine, why don't you lead us off?
I think I got to go with the tariffs. I mean, he's really very serious about just putting enormous tariffs on everything. Now, like, can he do it in every case? Unclear. Will he remember that that's what he ran on? Also unclear. Is it 10%? Is it 20%? Is it 60% for China? Also unclear, but that does actually strike me as sort of an existential threat to the country if he gets anywhere near to implementing it. So I think it would be good if we continued to do global trade.
Wow. Cuck. Nick, what's your existential Trump fear?
That RFK Jr. gets put in charge of animal control. And if you think traffic's bad now... Just wait. With Trump, I think the deportation camps are absolutely frightening, and it requires the people who support him and who dismiss him as a blowhard and a bullshit artist and all of the things that he is. He's been talking about this a lot. J.D. Vance is talking about it a lot. If that goes into anything approaching what they're talking about at the scale they're talking about, means all of us are going to have to show our papers, because I don't know about you, you know, I'm the grandchild of immigrants, and most, if not all, immigrants coming into the country now are whiter than I am. This isn't the type of world where it's like, okay, well, we know only illegal immigrants will have to show ID, et cetera. It'll be really, really bad.
I think that there's a school of thought of people of Trump's a blowhard, he's BSing. You take him with some, you know, somewhere in between serious and literal. But one thing I think that people have kind of forgotten of their already process is that he went ahead and tried to do that Muslim ban last time.
He
was pretty chaotic.
It, and it got pulled back.
It got pulled back, but it was serious chaos for people who were legal residents of this country and they couldn't fly back in, and all the airports went crazy. I know we've forgotten, but it like actually happened, so he can do stuff. Peter, what's your Trump fear?
So, I mean, I think tariffs and immigration are my top two policy fears, but just more than that, I worry that Trump will try to use the government
and in particular the Department of Justice, as a tool for personal vengeance, and that he will go after his political enemies, that he will go after his enemies in the media. He has threatened repeatedly to do things like pull the broadcast licenses of major networks. He's currently suing the Washington Post and some other, I think CBS as well, for just insane amounts for things. This is not going to be a sort of wholesale attack on every American's free speech, but that what he will end up doing is exerting a chilling effect on journalism, on critics, and that by going after them, he will basically, that will be his agenda, is the government is me, and it exists to serve Donald Trump and to serve his personal craziness, because that is what drives him. There is an argument to be made that Donald Trump only became president because he decided to run after what the Atlantic writer McKay Coppins made fun of him. I think that we might end up experiencing the reverse of that.
I think McKay told that story, yeah.
But we might end up experiencing a version of that from the White House. People say, well, look, it didn't happen last time. He did kind of try to go after some of his media critics, but he was restrained, you know, by the system's held. There were people in his orbit that ensured that he wasn't going to do stuff that was too bad. And there is a concerted effort this time to surround him with people who are not going to restrain him, and that worries me very much.
So you're saying the people who are voting for Donald Trump because they care about free speech might be not thinking it through?
I think that there may be another thought to have there.
I would add on the Trump thing is the way, and this is kind of to his credit, but just the way that the magnetism of his popularity eventually forces everyone who wants to stay into Republican politics to totally embarrass themselves as human beings. There's something that's degrading to the polity of the Republican Party to watch that happen in real time. There's a few holdouts who have managed to maintain some level of integrity, but people eventually have to figure out a way to kiss the ring and like sign on to a lot of irrational like statements and things, and it just feels unseemly. Like I think it makes all of us a little bit smaller, and I don't like that feeling for this country, Nick Gillespie. Speaking of Nick Gillespie, let's now look at silver linings for both candidates, and let's start with Trump. Trump is not uniformly evil, Nick, from what I understand, listening to the Recent Roundtable podcast every week with you. So what's a possible upside to a Trump presidency?
Possible upside to a Trump presidency is that he actually does an immigration policy that he talked about months ago, so he probably doesn't remember. And, you know, it is worth thinking about, like, the mental competency question, because Biden, as everybody understood for months, except the people around him and most of the people in the media, he was having problems partly because of his age. We're all getting older and we're all getting dumber. No question about it. You know, you got to give Robert F. Kennedy Jr. He's right about that. The seed oils are everywhere.
Push-ups.
And then there, yeah, and the lack of testosterone. You know, we need to be upping our testosterone more and more. But Trump may not remember, but he had an immigration policy where he said, yeah, anybody who gets an associate's degree, a BA, an MA, a PhD, maybe not a PhD, maybe you should kick them out, but, you know, automatically gets a green card or legal status. I could see him flipping very quickly because he doesn't care that much about what's going on. He wants people to follow him and to be bold, et cetera. I could see him pulling off something like that. It's not quite Nixon going to China. And of course, the tragedy of Nixon going to China is that he came back. But I could see Trump doing something like that. Because in the end, Trump does understand that economies flourish when there's a lot of energy and a lot of people coming in.
Peter?
So my dream for the Trump administration, it's a fantasy, but my dream is that it's not a Trump administration, is that it's an Elon Musk administration. And I mean this, I understand, this is total fantasy on my part. And yes, Elon Musk is out there talking about cutting $2 trillion from the federal budget. I'm not even talking about that, though that would be great. But like, he has no idea. He has no idea. No, the Elon Musk administration that Trump could preside over would not be so much about, there'd be some government reform, but it'd be like, let's forget all that and let's just make awesome rockets.
and let's just make America about dreaming about awesome rockets. Because the moment in the past couple of years when I have been proudest to be both a human and an American was when Elon Musk caught a skyscraper on another skyscraper with a couple of little chopsticks sticking out of it. And one of the skyscrapers was on fire while it happened. And that was awesome. It was so awesome. And imagine if Elon Musk could just say, look, that's what America is about, and everything, and we're going to redesign America and reimagine America to make that more possible. The California Coastal Commission can suck eggs. We're going to get rid of NEPA, right? So, like, there's some real reforms here, but it's just about, like, let's do that over and over again. And Elon Musk can make his trillions or his billions off of this. And Donald Trump can take credit, because that's all he wants. Take credit for the rockets. Make America about rockets again.
Points. Points for keeping Catherine awake. That was very.
I mean, you can have a race, Peter. Congratulations, you did it.
It's usually not that obvious, Catherine. surely you have some upside.
Yeah, it's just the things that Trump wouldn't do that are appealing, right? The things that he didn't do during his first term are really underappreciated. He didn't add nearly as much to the Federal Register as Clinton would have. He didn't. He just didn't do big new regulatory initiatives. And it's the seen and the unseen. Like, he's out there doing genuinely bad things every Tuesday. And so it's hard to appreciate the things that didn't happen. But I do think a reasonable expectation under a Trump administration, not that he will be a deregulator, I think we learned, or as Matt would put it on Reason's cover, the deregulator, question mark.
It's fair. It was early.
It was early. There will be regulations that are never heard of, that are never born, that never exist under a Trump administration that would otherwise exist.
His 2-for-1 rule was pretty interesting. I think it was killing.
He didn't do it.
He did it. Actually, they passed a 2-for-1 rule. I mean, there's some wiggle room in there, but yeah. I mean,
they said those words, I guess, on paper. But
are you saying that Donald Trump is not an entirely serious person?
That's not actually what I'm saying. I'm saying that he was the best deregulatory president since we had actual deregulatory presidents like Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan back in the day. I would add to the upside of a Trump presidency is education policy. Unlike Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, and Barack Obama, he doesn't like to use Title IX to create kangaroo courts for sexual assault cases on college campuses. And so he'll probably reverse that rule again. And we're living through a moment of a lot of pretty radical school choice actions happening in the states. And he would be an accelerationist, I think, for that. He's definitely been cheering it on. I think we'd have the biggest chance of actual getting rid of the Department of Education, which has been just sort of a pipe dream forever.
Yeah.
I think there's actual kind of motivation for that. And that would be interesting. As far as I can tell. Now, upsides, Kamala Harris presidency. Catherine, I know you can do it.
She would keep the congressional Republicans from doing whatever it is that they want to do.
That's it.
But they might keep her from doing whatever she wants to do.
Also good. I'm in favor of both of those things. I am pro-choice. I'm radically pro-choice. I think a Harris administration would be better for those of us who would like abortions to be legal. I would not enjoy it if she did the thing that is traditionally the first thing the Democrats do, which is use a bunch of federal money to pay for people's abortions. I don't think we need to do that. But I think Trump doesn't care about abortion. He said that pretty directly, in fact. Elizabeth Nolan Brown's newsletter this week was a ranking of the two candidates on sex and tech, since the newsletter is sex and tech. She says she thinks Trump would be worse on sex and that they would both be quite bad on tech. So Harris would probably be better for abortion rights.
You're a lady. Do you have a sense? There's been a lot of reporting now, like big poll, the Seltzer poll that everyone totally knew everything about 3 days ago, and other signs that there's a lot of, especially older women who are like leading a lot of pro-Harris sentiment out there. You have book clubs. Are they all like excited about
she
Harris?
She has so many book clubs.
I have 3 book clubs, but only one of them is full of the kind of voters that you're talking about. I'm going to like be fine with the fact, I guess, that you just asked me like how middle-aged women are doing.
Yep. Yep.
Because
I think I said older. Let's be honest about that.
I do have information about that. Yeah, they're pretty worried about Donald Trump. I have absolutely no idea how this manifests in people showing up to the polls because no one does.
Nick, what is your case for Kamala Harris?
She's going to be great on weed, on marijuana policy. Trump, going back to 2016, said that he would sign any legislation that came across his desk, descheduling, unscheduling, rescheduling, legalizing weed at the federal level. But it's kind of a background thing. He also, at various points, talks about that and about freeing Ross Ulbricht, but then also putting drug dealers to death. So, you know, we're not sure where the wheel is going to stop on, you know, on that particular...
No whammies.
Could be a big whammy there.
Do you think...
Kamala, who is terrible, you know, historically on this, put a lot of people in jail for smoking weed, using weed, carrying weed, talking about weed, you name it. She has come across and said, you know, it should not be... It shouldn't be illegal. So I think that's good. And the reason why that's good, I don't even use weed. But I want to live in a world where... I want to live in a world where people are not put in jail for choosing one intoxicant over the other. You know, that's a better world. And this is one of those threads. Well, that is, and I am just want to talk about my bravery now in saying that weed should be legal at the Comedy Cellar Village Underground in front of a bunch of libertarians. But this,
so brave.
You know, the whole question about drug policy, which is faded, and even among many libertarians, for reasons that I just find ridiculous, but like this is a thread, when you pull on it, it changes so many other things. It changes foreign policy, it changes criminal justice reform, it changes the ways that we deal with the Constitution and the courts. This is an important thread to be pulling. It's well past time, you know, just to make weed legal, or at least as legal as beer, wine, and alcohol, which I also don't use.
Do you, in your heart of hearts, think that...
I have no heart.
That's true. Think that Donald Trump would pardon Ross Ulbricht, as he has promised his friends in the Libertarian Party.
Yeah, I hope that he does. Ross Ulbricht has served more than enough time for the crimes of which he was convicted. I don't know. I don't trust Donald Trump on you know, pretty much anything, other than that the stakes were great. And unfortunately, I can't buy the steaks anymore. So,
I kind of feel like the most likely outcome, just based on history, is that he pardons Ulbricht, but then somehow, like, puts him back in jail too. Like, I can't sketch it out exactly, but that's
the vibe.
He has
to become Barron's butler.
Yeah.
Barron, are you here, by the way? Goes to school, like right around the corner. Peter, what's your upside of a Kamala Harris presidency? And if you use the phrase abundance agenda, I'm going to throw a bottle of water at your head. Go.
So you predicted where I'm going. Just like Kamala Harris is going to end up predicting this. Because look, the worst thing about Kamala Harris is that she's kind of an empty vessel. She has no vision. She has no ideology beyond sort of being vaguely leftist. She was super progressive when the Democratic Party was super progressive. And now that like people are like, wait, maybe we're a little crazy in 2019 and 2020. She's like, maybe we're a little crazy. But she won't like actually say, oh, I've turned for these reasons. She doesn't have a reason. The reason is it's no longer popular. And so it might end up being, you can imagine a scenario in which Kamala Harris ends up being a much less progressive Democrat in the way that she governs, and that she ends up being kind of like an early iteration of like a Democratic Party AI, right? An LLM, like, and all, you know, just like all of the stuff that's out there right now in the Substack verse, like it just sort of gets fed into the Harris brain, and she spits it out in like, you know, eighth grade prose that is pretty passable, and it makes enough sense. And it's the abundance agenda stuff. And it's no longer Lena Khan and a bunch of crazy activists. It's just like, yeah, you know, we should do stuff that makes housing less expensive, more affordable and more available. And we should probably apply that to the rest of the economy as well. It's not a completely crazy idea, I think, because she is somebody who is such an empty vessel, just so unwilling to sort of stake out novel policy territory on her own. The fact... The, the energy in the Democratic Party is with the abundance agenda right now, and that energy might end up transferring itself into the Harris persona.
I will vote here, and this is not a cop-out, I swear, but the best thing about a Kamala Harris presidency will be that, crossing fingers, that will be the end of the Donald Trump era, as far as we know. And I don't say that out of the... I'm not overflowing with contempt for Donald Trump. Okay, a little bit I am. But like, the era hasn't been great. It hasn't been great, as mentioned before, about what it's done for just kind of the basic integrity of Republican politics. I think it's brought a lot of populism and bad economic policy into the Republican Party, including, so the tariffs, but also he thinks he's going to get the tariffs and scrap the tax code at the same time. He's not. Yeah. It's like a reverse UBI. You know, like, people are like, let's do UBI because we'll get rid of the welfare state. Nope. The welfare state stays, and now you have UBI as well. That's what he's doing. Anyways, it's all not super great, and I'm looking forward to what happens afterwards. I don't know what it's going to be. Maybe it looks just like Trump, but just there's something about him. So that, to me, is the best thing. But the best thing about her campaign, at least, for me, and it's been a surprise, given her role in the 2020 election, is that she really has de-emphasized identity politics in a just kind of really surprising way, considering, like, do you guys remember the video that was right before that little animation thing where she was explaining, this is like a day and a half before the 2020 election, like, equity means that everybody gets, like, pulled up into the, like, in front in the starting line, and that's how we do it for it. It was really, really awful. She basically was making equity being the same thing as equality, which it's not, and it gets
and all. And they're always watching a baseball game. Right?
Always.
They're always at the back of a field.
That's not a thing that happens anymore. But so she has several times in the two interviews that she's given, chosen not to emphasize that. I find that refreshing. However, there's nothing attached to it. Like, they're not going to undo all of the mess of, you know, whole of government executive orders that the Biden administration did in its first week, having to look at the sort of DEI calculation of every single government agency.
At the same time, there was a report not very long ago that Kamala Harris, as vice president, like, one of the things she did was look at a bunch of, like, I think it was regulatory language.
Oh, that's true.
And, like, go through, like, all the references to women, minority, like, and then, like, basically say, this is really offensive, and you've gotten it all wrong. And, like, basically, they had to do a control F for all of the references to appease her, and that was the thing that she prioritized on, like, a bunch of big policy decisions.
That it was sort of like a sexist kind of sounding when we're talking. Yeah, it was not super great. All right, we had a huge round of applause earlier for Chase Oliver voters here. So I think it behooves us to talk at least a little bit about something that really hasn't gotten a lot of coverage at all in this election, which is the third party vote, the independent vote, the weirdos, the you people. Whether it be Chase Oliver or RFK is still on 31 ballots, people. It's really funny. Jill Stein is on 37 ballots, which is more than last time. The Green Party had, you had the Constitution Party. I think Gloria De La Riva is still running for president constantly. This will be a round of make any kind of prediction, comment, or whatever about something happening in the third party space, either with Chase Oliver or somebody else. What do you think? What's a possibility? What are we not wrapping our heads around here on these last waning hours before the election? Nick, why don't you start?
This is a wish and a dream. God, if you're out there, I just hope, I really, really hope that RFK Jr. pulls enough votes to cover the spread.
Oh my God,
between
yes.
Trump and Harris.
I was looking today. He's polling at 3% in Michigan.
Yeah, no, it's all there.
Can you imagine?
And what's going to happen then? Because he'll take it to the House of Representatives, and, you know, when it comes down to the swimsuit and push-up competition, he's going to win. I think he's going to win. So
multiple people on this stage were worried earlier that no one would win. And so if RFK is the spoiler that causes no one to win,
it's going to be amazing.
It's pretty fun.
Can someone bring me some fluoride right now, please?
But then we're all winners. We're all winners.
Catherine, what's your crystal ball tell you?
So I was similarly thinking about potential spoilers, and I find myself nostalgic for the time when people got absolutely furious at libertarians for being the spoilers.
Including Chase Oliver in Georgia, right? That's mm-hmm. not a small
and,
thing.
And our yeah. the current LP nominee made his name as a spoiler. I do not necessarily see that happening this time around. And so I guess my hope is that somehow the LP would perform above expectations and be a spoiler. I think it is more likely that it will be RFK, or I don't think we're giving enough credit slash blame here to Jill Stein, mm-hmm. who... You know, unlike libertarian candidates, and I think RFK, who are pulling from both parties, and therefore it's actually hard to do a spoiler analysis. I just, it's a hard for me to envision the Jill Stein Trump voter. Mm. Like, I'm sure they exist, and maybe one of them
possibly,
is here tonight.
Yeah, here.
But, like, maybe the only one is here tonight. So I think that's, you know, she still has kind of a pathway to be a clearer spoiler in a straightforward sense, and I would enjoy that outcome as well.
Cornel West is also, I think, on 15 ballots.
Wow.
And the entire time he is polled way above you would expect Cornel West to poll. I don't know if it's a name recognition. I say that with great affection for the man. And I mean that. Not necessarily for his politics. I think there's an underrated part about comparing the 2016 to the 2020 election is the third party and independent vote. 2016 relatively was a high water mark or a recent spike year. 5%+ of the vote went towards third party and independents. And then that kind of collapsed in 2020. And those people, by and large, came back and voted for Joe Biden, mostly as a one-time deal. So Gary Johnson got 3.3% in 2016, Joe Jorgensen, I think, got 1.2%, but she was still getting two-thirds of the entire third-party vote. Donald Trump got the same number of votes, basically same percentage in both elections, but mm-hmm. the Democrat received all of that. Early in this election cycle, there was a lot. I mean, if you still go on Real Clear Politics now and just like mash the, give me the three-way with RFK, the last polls...
No, thank you.
There's a drum set just right there. Dude was pulling like 15-20%. It's crazy. I think that there is a third party energy. There's been no discussion about it. It's weirdly dissipated in all of the third parties, including whole sections of the Libertarian Party, have been mesmerized by the kind of, I don't know, something about Donald Trump. And so maybe that has collapsed, but I kind of don't think. I mean, I have just this lingering suspicion that whatever energy that is of, you know, being double haters in Catherine's words, that will be expressed somehow. So I think there's still some surprise left in the third party vote. And there's enough states. I mean, the whole thing's a toss up. I think there's going to be more potential for really juicy recriminations. At least I'm hoping for it.
I actually think the opposite. I think that the third party vote is going to underwhelm this time. And that as a result, it is going to diminish hopes in third parties going forward. I'm not saying this because I think it's a good thing, but this was an election where third parties should have ruled, because it was an election between two people that everyone hates. And it is an election about who you hate more. But it turns out that in an election where the primary goal is just to stop the person that you hate the most, then third parties don't do that. And so third parties end up being weaker players in that environment. And I think that we're going to come away from this election with a diminished expectation for what third parties can do.
Do we think quickly, since we're going to get that question, I just want to forestall it, that the intramural fighting in the Libertarian Party, where you have a lot of the leadership, doesn't actually like Chase Oliver and spends their time berating, you know, reason for being insufficiently pro-Trump. Do you think that's going to translate into a diminished support for Chase Oliver, or do the people who vote Libertarian not pay any attention to any of this shit?
I have to believe that absolutely no one gives a shit about what is happening in the leadership of the Libertarian Party, and that is a thing that makes me proud about America. That said, I do think ballot access matters, and I think Oliver's on in 47 states. Could be more, could have been more, and I think that there will be, you know, ballot access cascades. The more of it you have, the more of it you have, and so I worry about what happens down the line structurally.
New York was always going to be tough because New York really sucks for competition. If you ever someone in New York tries to tell you about how like Georgia has bad democracy, punch them in the face. Like,
don't punch them. No punching. No punching. The non-aggression principle. Matt.
Make punch. Don't punch people.
We actually had several DC Reason staffers who were like aggressively grumpy about having to write in Chase Oliver because he did not make the ballot in DC, feeling that it's somehow more humiliating to have to do a write-in than to vote third party. And I think that that's true.
Nick, any final thoughts on Chase LP, third parties, anything?
Not really. I mean, I suspect that we're going to see a return to a pre-Gary Johnson level of libertarian vote, which is, you know, well under 1%.
I wanted to get to, because again, this will come up in the questions, a very quick, not belabored, idea of what each person's here's best case scenario is. Not who you're voting for, because we know Catherine's never going to vote, but what is the result on Wednesday that you would most prefer to see? Catherine.
A landslide for either candidate.
There we go. Yeah. Peter.
Divided government. Divided government, and that probably means Kamala Harris winning, because if Kamala Harris wins, then it is likely that at least one chamber of Congress will be Republican-controlled.
Nick?
Yeah, I think historically divided government with a Democratic president and a Republican Congress or split Congress has worked out better than alternative.
Buttress all of that and the nonsense I was saying earlier. Semi-landslide, I mean, landslide, but not too landslidey, right? You don't want to like it like Reagan landslide. Do you really want?
I mean, the word mandate doesn't mean anything anymore, so they're going to say it whether they win by one vote or a million. We might as well just have a definitive landslide.
Decisive enough.
Yeah, but we've had those. And I mean, it's good in the short term, right? Because nobody's talking about voter fraud and that kind of bullshit. But inevitably, and this is the history of the 21st century, is it leads to overreach in the first 2 years, and then you start getting the reverse, and we don't get anywhere. We're stuck bouncing back between thesis and antithesis with no synthesis other than bigger government and more despair.
Calm down, Hegel.
You had me mesmerized there. All right. After we talk in this round, we're going to open this up for questions. Again, questions, but we like to
By questions, we mean long-winded statements.
Yes.
Yeah. I'll take the first.
Yeah. But we like to, as those loyal listeners know, like to end our podcast with things that we have been consuming in the cultural arena. And when we do these live shows, we like to sort of tie it in with themes that we've been hitting. One theme that we're all kind of experiencing in one way or the other is that it's the end of the world as we know it, beginning on Tuesday. So let's go for a round of apocalyptic themed fiction, nonfiction, literature, TVs, whatever, that will either get us through the night or get us to our eternal sleep. Catherine?
My recommendation will literally get you through the entire time between now and when the polls close, which is Dan Carlin's Blueprint for Armageddon. It is hours and hours and hours of history podcast about World War I. And I feel like maybe as soon as this podcast is over, I'm just going to put in my earbuds and start playing this Dan Carlin, and it will still be going.
Do you have earbuds in right with your hair? We can't tell.
I have them in right now. I've actually just been listening to Dan Carlin's podcast. Nick interviewed Dan Carlin, did a great interview, so you could actually start with Nick's interview and then Blueprint for Armageddon if you like. But high quality history podcast, it will remind you that things could absolutely be worse.
Peter?
Things could be worse. We could be in a zombie apocalypse. So I'm going to recommend 28 Days Later. So 28 Days Later was written by the guy who wrote Civil War, who wrote and directed Civil War, which came out earlier this year. And both of those movies share a theme, which is they are about what happens when the institutions that hold society together break down. And what it turns out happens is people go crazy and they start killing each other, and it's real bad. And so in 28 Days Later, it starts when a bunch of viral monkeys escape from a lab. And I kind of feel like that might have been what happened here in America. So the viral monkeys escape in this movie. And then a guy wakes up. It's 28 days later after the viral monkeys. And it turns out everybody's either dead or a zombie. Bad news. So he meets some other people. They go on a road trip. And there's a lot of violence. And there's a lot of craziness. And people are really scared. And at the end, they end up in this camp that promises safety. And the camp is like, well, we're a bunch of like former ex-Marine type guys. You know, we're going to protect you. But it turns out they're just a bunch of crazy authoritarian madmen, because people turn to crazy authoritarian madmen when they are concerned for their safety. It's not great, but it is a chilling picture of what happens when society breaks down. Also, those viral monkeys that were infected with a virus that the scientists in the lab call rage. It's the rage virus. Well, the rage virus was let loose when a bunch of lefty activist assholes broke in and did something stupid and let the rage monkeys out. And I feel like that kind of explains a lot of America right now.
Nick, what's your rage monkey?
That's, I feel like it's 28 days later.
Yeah.
I'm gonna suggest a after-school special called Cypher in the Snow.
It's so good. So good.
I'm gonna go with the 1950 novel Barabbas by a Swedish writer named Per Lagerkvist. It's a short novel, and it is.
I'm Wikipediaing this right now.
How many of you know who Barabbas is? Wow. Okay. Well, he's a New Testament figure who gets ransomed in the place of Jesus in one of the Gospels. And so Barabbas is a murderer, a thief, a killer, a rapist. You know, in other words, somebody who might be in the second Trump administration. And he is freed. And it's just, okay, you're free. You can go live your life. And he has this unearned grace. Lagerkvist was a Christian existentialist novel writer. But what it's about is, like, you are already free, and how do you make meaning in your life? And I think this is a great book to be reading right now, because politics are terrible, but politics are always terrible, and we have an immense amount of freedom and the ability to determine what matters in our life. We need to be like Barabbas, not tomorrow or on Wednesday, but starting today. Find your purpose and live your purpose. It's a beautiful short book. Barabbas from 1950 by Per Lagerkvist.
My choice is a book by William Shirer, the author of The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. He wrote a book that's much less well known called The Collapse of the Third Republic, about basically trying to figure out, and he was a correspondent in both Germany and France. He worked for the expatriate newspapers in Paris in the 20s and 30s. He was just trying to explore how it was that France folded like a cheap tent in 1940. It's a little bit rude put that way, but...
To tents.
anyways, it's a great book. It's sort of a history of political and intellectual and moral rot of a nation. How a once proud nation that's doing a lot of things right and is kind of a leader in culture and some economics can basically talk itself into defeat and ruin. It's just a masterclass. And I was just looking at it today and realized, which I didn't before, that it came out in 1968 or 1969. So that's a pretty interesting time to be kind of looking back at why the country that he loved most of all, France, had fallen down. It has some resonance, as does a lot of 1930s, what happened in Europe kind of books does to our, not necessarily even American moment, but current global moment, where sort of a descent into insane ideas about how nuclear weapons are created by demons who scratched your shoulder when you were sleeping with your four dogs and whatever the hell is occurring to Tucker Carlson as we speak. So check it out. He's not a character in that book as far as I know, but I might need to reread it. Okay, I see a microphone over here, ladies and gentlemen. We have some time before our cutoff, which is going to be hard at 7:40. Surely Jerry Orstrom has a question that he wants to ask here and might be there. If there's no questions, we'll scat up here. That's not a problem. Here we go.
We will not be doing that.
Peter was threatening. Did you remember?
That's true.
Hello. Sir. Might something boring like ranked choice voting or open primaries help solve this nonsense?
I'm so happy that we had a ranked choice voting question. Yeah. This is honestly the only thing keeping some people in the Reason DC office alive right now. We did, as we always do, our forum where we ask everyone how they're going to vote. But we also asked, like, what other things are you keeping an eye on? Ballot initiatives, that kind of thing. Many ranked choice voting enthusiasts in our numbers. I want to believe. I really do. And there's like some evidence in the places where ranked choice voting exists that maybe things are loosened up and a little more calm and rational. I will say every single time we talk about ranked choice voting, I get a whole bunch of emails from people that are like, actually, there's another system that's similar to ranked choice voting, but better. And I assume that will occur at the drinks afterward. Mm-hmm. So please come to me with your actually. Yeah, see? That guy.
They're actually, all the emails are from.
That guy, maybe. And I love them because I do think, yes, structural reforms are probably the way out. And that's at least one of them.
It's all our fault. So I don't know. Nick, anything else? I said questions, not like...
You're all our fault, spitting. Matt Welch. Yeah. You are all our fault. All right. The least or most favorite cinematic president. And here's where it's interesting. You cannot do Michael Douglas in American President. Mm-hmm. Anyone else, but not him. Least or worst, across the board.
Nick, I think you need to start.
Obviously, the president in Idiocracy is great, but what I want to point out.
Can you do the whole
impression?
Name?
But Bob Newhart was in a great movie about the president where he's just a mean son of a bitch. I think it's called First Family or something like that. I highly recommend it. There's a scene where he taunts the representative from Rhode Island with a presidential pen after signing a bill, and he makes the guy who's very short jump up for it. It's one of the best performances. It's one of the best portrayals of presidential power.
So the alternative to 28 Days Later that I was thinking about was Escape from New York, which is a fantastic movie that has a truly terrible sequel, Escape from Los Angeles. Yeah. Came out in the 1990s. And the president in the Escape from Los Angeles version is just John Ashcroft. That's all it is. And he's terrible. He's just the worst possible sort of version of the 90s religious right president. So I think probably he's my least favorite, but mainly I want to talk about this so that I can deliver the like a version of the quote that I think about all the time that most expresses my politics from the first movie, Escape from New York. I don't give a fuck about your war or your president. Snake Plissken was right.
Yeah.
Catherine.
I'm going to go with my least favorite fictional president, which is definitely, and I say this with all apologies to Stephanie Slade, Jed Bartlett from West Wing. That man brought more people to Washington, D.C. thinking they were about to do something.
That's my answer too, Bill. And it's mostly because they never go away. I think there's like a Lincoln Project ad right now with like bringing the cast of the West Wing back to tell you why, not really why you need to vote for Kamala Harris, but why you need to donate money to the Lincoln Project, which is forever their political project. Bunch of goddamn hacks. Yes, sir.
All right. 14th presidential election with a libertarian on the ballot. 12th candidate. Who's your pantheon? Who's your favorite?
Ooh.
Gary Johnson.
Yeah. Gar Joe.
I don't vote. For a reason.
Yeah, I'll also throw in Ed Clark and the David Koch ticket from 1980. Not only did they turn a lot of people to thinking about libertarianism, they ran on a platform where they wanted to abolish the FBI and the CIA in 1980, and they almost got a million votes. So.
But also, like, pro-gay marriage and drug legalization.
Yeah, yeah, no, they were the full package.
Called themselves low-tax liberals, if I recall correctly. I'll say Garjo, too, largely just because we got to know him. I got to know him a little bit in the process, and it's rare that you meet someone in politics that you actually enjoy and like, so it's totally, like, a personal thing.
I guess,
except he showed us his horrible foot, Nick. Remember that?
Yeah. He lost
before
part of his toe.
Before we talk about this more, I do feel like we do need to have a little Ron Paul minute, right? Like a lot of people did come into the movement because of him.
It was 1988, though. I mean, like, I don't really remember that.
Not as the LP president. But
not as the LP, but like...
Yeah, Ron Paul is...
Gotta give that man his props.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sir, yes, sir.
Realistically, what do you think the third parties in this country can do to improve their performance and impact?
Just find a candidate that people like. Like, that's really my big idea.
Clone Jill Stein.
Like, I actually like Chase Oliver a lot. He seems like he's basically right about a lot of things, but there has to be one person in this enormous country who's libertarian that the American public would be like, okay.
Yes and no. I mean, like, no, I'm thinking in terms of what Peter was talking about before, like when people are all hepped up, when voter turnout's really high because everyone's really frightened about that the other bad person might win, it's a real bad time for third parties. And this is something that Gary Johnson experienced in New Mexico in 2018, I think it was, when he was running for Senate. Went down there and covered that. It was really, really interesting. Two-time former governor, very well-known, running against some absolute nobody Republican guy named Mark Rich, and then an incumbent Democrat. And, you know, he was kind of polling at least competitively for a while. He got thumped. He got like 18%. The Republican got 36% with zero name recognition. No one had ever heard of him. Didn't raise much money, like a pathetic thing. But he was Republican, and people just say, all right, I'm voting for Republican. And it's like, if you can't even get more than 18% in your home state where people really liked you as a popular two-term governor, where he got pretty good vote numbers in the Libertarian, I think got something like 15%. Don't quote me on that. But when he's running for president, that says to me that it's very, very difficult structurally to get something done. I think that one thing that has happened to the Libertarian Party and to most other third parties at various times is that they got intoxicated by Trump, not necessarily even by him as a person, although some of that has happened, but just that he did this shortcut. Like, he said all the crazy things and people liked him. That seems like fun. Don't you want to do something like that? It was so tempting for people to feel like there's a workaround that you can do from the normal kind of boring, stuffy politics, and you can be popular. You can go on social media and be a troll, and it's fun, and you get votes this way. And I think a lot of people thought that they could either do that or they could partner enough with him and sort of enjoy his fun by joining the team. And I understand the appeal. That's where the aforementioned Ross Ulbricht vow probably came from, the Libertarian Party doing that business with Donald Trump. So hopefully there is value with that comes out. But I think for the long-term health of any party, you got to slog it out and say, this is what we're doing for the long haul. And eventually, if we keep our marbles and don't go chasing squirrels, then we can get somewhere.
Yeah, the function of third parties too can be to put, you know, alternative ideas into the air that then get taken up by other people. And this is something like, you know, the multiple presidential candidate Norman Thomas did, et cetera. Like, if you put out serious policy proposals and, you know, they can be taken up by major parties and actually change things. And that's the point. The point isn't to win and get office. The point is to change policy.
The The Libertarian Party right now is on, it's hard to imagine them on a winning streak right now because they're not on a winning streak, but they are on the first streak of any party since at least the 19th century, and I think maybe even of all time, depending on how you define socialist parties at various times. They came in third place for three consecutive presidential elections, and their share of the third party or independent vote the last, I think, three elections was their top three in that. Like Joe Jorgensen got like 64% of the independent and third party vote. So I thought, and you know, I'm very possibly wrong about this, but I thought that there's value into saying the third party in America is the Libertarian Party. That's how it has been for the last 10 plus years. And a great open question about this is that going to be true this time? They're on the most ballots. They have a two or three election streak of outpolling every single other third party or indie candidate in every single state. Is that going to continue? And is there value in that? It kind of feels like it's sort of getting a bit mushy around the edges. So, yes,
ma'am. I love it when we get like baseball nerd slash crucial Waukesha County Matt. We get him like a couple days a year where he's like, "Well, I've done the numbers. It's my favorite."
That's
Matt.
That's not a nice accent. Yes, ma'am.
Hey, what's your take on how the mainstream media has covered this election, and just what are your thoughts generally about the influence of the legacy media in elections? Thanks.
Someone not named me.
I think the mainstream media or the legacy media sucked in covering this campaign on every possible level. And there's again, my bravery, you know, inspires even myself in saying that, but. You know, that I mean, we cannot let the mainstream media have a pass on how they covered Biden until Biden forced that early debate. And then it was like, okay. And then you know, like some of the same people were like, oh my God, can you believe how bad Biden is? They knew it all along. So there's that. The kid gloves towards Harris is also unforgivable and inexcusable, and it helps explain why fewer and fewer people believe legacy media institutions. They are constantly taking Trump out of context, and I think Jacob Sullum and other people at Reason have pointed out, like, why would you do that? You don't have to take Donald Trump out of context in order to make him look like an idiot if you disagree with him. But they keep doing it. And that's a real problem. You know, I've written a lot about declines in trust and confidence in all sorts of institutions in America. It's really a problem when the media is this shitty, the big media. But that is changing, and people are leaving it and routing around it. It does not mean everything is rosy, because a lot of new media is bullshit too, such as Tucker Carlson. You know, who is now going on demonology trips and things like that. And I look forward to his, you know, course on the rapture and how to get ready for it. But, you know, it's like the question was, how did the media do? Terribly.
Notes?
I mean, I also think there's just this, you know, we're now a decade, more than a decade into every reporter, many, many reporters in mainstream outlets thinking that they're going to be the guy who finds the one little tidbit that's really the thing that finally turns people against Trump. That guy doesn't exist. You can't be that guy, because that is just not how it works. And it's interesting to me that people are operating on this kind of extremely outdated theory of how to change the electorate. Like, even if you accept, as I don't think we should, that it's okay, you know, it's okay for these mainstream papers to have a side and to just advocate for that side. Still, we found his receipts from the last five restaurants he went to and he tipped really bad. Is not the thing that's going to change people's votes. And of course, most of the time, it's far, far, far worse than that. And it still doesn't change people's votes. So I think that theory of what mainstream journalism is for in election season is just like radically wrong. And yet people cannot be swayed from it.
The mainstream media has covered this election in a way that nearly guarantees that the next election or the election after that, they will no longer be the mainstream. And there may no longer be any mainstream.
Sounds fine to me.
I have a long piece in the next issue of Reason Magazine on this topic.
It's really good.
I recommend that I read it. Yes, sir.
So I'm curious. I think It's much more likely that an adversarial press would be existent in one of these administrations as opposed to the other. So,
can you guess which one?
Yeah. I have some thoughts.
Yeah.
So, is there potentially an argument for voting for that candidate in the hopes that they'll be hamstrung by the sway of popular opinion polling?
That is. I don't know how many dimensions are in that chess. But I think I don't know. I think I saw it in Star Trek. It would be. I mean, it would be great to have a president who was closely examined by the media in a meaningful way, especially with regard to their policy proposals. I think Peter is right that we're going to get there regardless, and maybe it's because people simply stopped taking legacy media seriously. I mean, it's already this, like, you know, the chitter chatter about like. How you do on Joe Rogan is going to determine whether or not you win the election. Like, that's not quite true yet, but it might be soon.
Yeah, so I think that the mainstream media has not done well this election in many ways. And there's a lot to criticize. At the same time, I'm not sure that we should be cheering on in just a straightforward way the death of legacy media, because the big newsrooms that we all hate, that we all love to hate, are also responsible for producing a lot of the granular fact-based knowledge that all of the independent media that we love and that we think is great rely on. And so a huge amount of just the kind of the fact patterns, the fact base for saying stuff about politics comes from CNN or the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times or Bloomberg, from these very large newsrooms that just are out there gathering facts and producing articles every day. And so this is going to be a decline that is in some ways deserved and is in some ways satisfying, but in other ways might have negative consequences for organizations and independent news media organizations that we like.
Reason is all you need. We're fine.
If you want a really adversarial press, elect Chase Oliver.
That's true. That is true. I would say that the way that the adversarial press unfortunately works now is to lob insults at Donald Trump from Brooklyn rather than actually investigate the results of policy. And that's a little bit of a crude caricature, but only a little bit. Like, we are not doing a lot of policy. It's looking for the thing that's going to finally get him over. Oh, Clarence Thomas has this friend, and that's finally going to delegitimize him once and for all. And it's not really looking at, I don't know, his jurisprudence or something. Yes.
Matt Welch asserted without evidence.
Again.
So I know it's a big thing with libertarians to not like the Federal Reserve. And of course, monetary policy is something that is controlled by the Federal Reserve. So my question is, if let's say you got the infinity gauntlet, snap your fingers, what would be the monetary policy that you think would be best for the country?
You would have already stopped talking by now.
Oh, no! Be nice!
Joking. Rude. I'm joking.
Rude.
Oh, that was the question. I think I got it out, didn't I? Yeah.
What would be the Federal Reserve policy?
What would be your monetary policy that you would enact if you could, you know, let's say snap your fingers and put it in place?
I guess we just put Satoshi in charge of the Fed. I don't know. Yeah. That's possible, right?
I don't. If I got the Infinity Gauntlet and the Time Stone, monetary policy would definitely not be the first thing I was thinking about.
One thing that's interesting to me is that Trump, to the extent Harris has no Fed policy, right? Trump has not really been talking about it other than to start asserting that the Fed should be less independent, which is troubling. I would love to see a diminution of the Fed's role in our lives on a general level. I don't ultimately care if it is abolished or not, but it should not be able to do all that it has been doing at various points throughout our lives. And if nothing else, just put it on autopilot.
Totally fair to get this question. This group of four is like the weakest sauce you could ever get on End the Fed libertarians. We're all like kind of in favor of it, but we just, none of us, it's not in our hearts, I don't think.
You just published an issue of the magazine that said abolish everything.
Including the Fed. To be clear, I did just publish an issue of the magazine with an article about how we should end the Fed. So there is
that. Seems like maybe we should abolish this podcast.
Every week.
I think that any public policy made in the year 1913 should be abolished, is my It's a deep cut. I got one applause over there. Are we?
We're done.
It's 7:40. I said 7:40 is the Bull Connor time. Thank you, everybody. Thank you to those watching at home. You're going to be herded out real quick. So I hope you settled your bill and tipped handsomely. Thanks again to Matt Ruby and everybody here at Village Underground. Goodbye.